Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Thomas Keith, co-editor with Peggy L. Fox of The Luck of Friendship, The Letters of Tennessee Williams and James Laughlin. We'll also hear from Minrose Gwynn, whose stunning new novel is Promise. Thomas Keith has been gracing the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival for many years. He brings his love of Tennessee Williams and theater experience. He teaches acting and theater at Pace University, as well as his editing experience at New Directions, Tennessee's publisher. And this year, he'll be talking about his new book, The Luck of Friendship, The Letters of Tennessee Williams and James Laughlin, which he edited with Peggy L. Fox, Tennessee's last editor. This book is a treasure, and Thomas is too. Thomas Keith, it's so good to have you back on The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, James Laughlin, the publisher of New Directions, worked with so many great writers. That's a publisher with a long and distinguished history. So this book is one of a series of his collected correspondences with writers. Am I right?
That's correct. Yeah, Laughlin was a singular figure in 20th century literary publishing. They sometimes refer to him as one of the last of the gentleman publishers, in that his house was independent, and it still is. New Directions is not owned by a larger corporation. And he was disinclined to write memoirs or write about himself. And finally, this idea came through his friends at W.W. Norton that they would produce a series of collections of his letters with some of his most famous authors. Already published are the selected letters of Ezra Pound and James Laughlin, William Carlos Williams, Delmore Schwartz, Kenneth Rexroth, Thomas Merton, Henry Miller, Guy Davenport, and now Tennessee Williams. And I think upcoming is Kay Boyle.
Wow. At last, Tennessee Williams. So talk about the process for something like this. It seems very tedious and very time-consuming.
It is time-consuming. But it's also wonderful. The most difficult part for Peggy and I was how many letters we could not include. There was a lot more correspondence. It's kind of stunning how much all of these people corresponded back then. And I've yet to figure out when we're going to see the collected emails of anybody.
I know. I worry about that, though, don't you?
I kind of do. But the project started when most of these books were assigned scholarly editors back in the 90s, and Peggy was the editor of this volume. And then she found she had too much going on, so she asked Laughlin if I could be her co-editor, which was wonderful. And we got going on it, and then James Laughlin died in 1997. And then we got working on it, but we also got distracted. At a certain point, I started working full-time at New Directions in 2001, and Peggy's husband died, and her life changed, and we only got back to it about 4 years ago. And so, as it turns out, we're very lucky because in the interim, several volumes of letters have been published, Tennessee Williams letters. The biography by Lahr came out. The biography of James Laughlin by Ian McNiven came out. And so we've had a lot more resources to look to, the notebooks, that kind of thing.
Of course. But you learn so much from reading letters. It's so interesting to me that for those of us who've heard Tennessee Williams' voice, and he is one of those playwrights whose audio recordings you can hear. And once you've heard his physical voice, you can hear it coming through loud and clear in these letters, don't you think?
Oh, I think so. And I think you hear a side of Williams when you read the letters that we don't always get from the news media and biographies and things. This is a less sensational Williams. He's down to earth. He's got the, what I refer to as Southern understatement. I don't know that that's necessarily just a Southern thing, because James Locke certainly has his own version of patrician understatement. But you get this focused, personal voice that we don't always hear. And it's delightful with these two men, because it seems that they maintain their friendship to a great extent in the correspondence.
And yet they were so different.
I think it's to both their credits, and it tells you something about both their characters in terms of how they related to people. They first met at a party at Lincoln Kirsten's in 1942, and they were aware of one another, and Williams introduced himself to Lachlan as a poet. And you read in the letters how he first sends him his poetry, and Lachlan's response is, "I think you are a poet."
Right.
And that's how they get started. So by the time Williams starts to have success as a playwright, he's already a New Directions writer. He's already on a very literary list. And they share an interest in letters, literature, and publishing. You can see this in the letters with all of Williams' interest, his detailed interest in cover designs and layouts and proof pages and that kind of thing.
The cover design stuff was fascinating to me. And then also that rivalry with Random House, too.
Right. Yeah, well, that's another thing, is that I think it's also an unusual situation in that all of Williams' major works, except for his memoirs, were published by New Directions. You know, there are always fallings out in conflict. For Lachlan, there was an issue with William Carlos Williams going off to, was at Random House, and Delmore Schwartz was always kicking up a fuss. Rex Roth, you read it in his letters, he was always quitting, "I'm going to go to somewhere else." But Williams and Lachlan remained faithful to one another in that sense. And Williams loved being on that list, and Lachlan also let him know that his being on that list and New Directions being able to make a little actual money off of his books enabled New Directions to bring out younger writers, poetry and translation, and all kinds of things that don't necessarily sell as well.
Well, that was one of the things that I loved learning about him, was how concerned he was for other writers.
And his generosity comes out. You get it when he's concerned with his health in the early 60s. He got very distressed when Frank Merlo was dying, and you see it in those letters where he's having panics about his health situation and the flop of Milk Train on Broadway, saying, "Well, I've got to put everything in order now." And as you get into the details of what he's putting in order, he's making sure that at least a dozen people in his life are provided for.
Now, one of the things that came home to me in reading this collection of letters was the sheer luck that some of Tennessee's work survived. He was always worried about getting it typed. He was always sending off his only copy to people. He moved a lot, and he wrote to Lachlan about what it was like to gather up all those miscellaneous papers. And so it seems to me that Lachlan had a great picture of the entire surround of his writing life.
He did, and you get a good sense of that in the book, and this is something that Peggy Fox can speak to because she worked with Williams for the last 7 years of his life. There was always a concern about him losing things, about the fact that he didn't number his pages. And one of the great characters in the book is Robert McGregor,
yes,
who ran the New Directions office from 1950 until his death in 1974, who became very close to Williams. In many instances with the major plays, there's a back and forth between Lachlan and McGregor about when will we get the script and what shape will it be in.
So what was it like to work with Peggy Fox? I mean, she was Tennessee's last editor.
It was wonderful to work with Peggy. She's also the person who hired me to work at New Directions back in 1987. Somebody offered me an opportunity to be a typist. In 1987 through 93, there were no computers. The editors would all draft their letters on typewriters, throw them in a basket. I would retype them with four blue carbons, type up the envelopes, clip everything together, and then they would mail them out. There was no fax machine. There were rotary phones. And part of what was exciting to me was having this connection through the editors, the people who worked there, through James Lachlan, who used to come in once a month, to this whole world of publishing and literature, which otherwise I didn't know all that much about.
Oh, what a gift. What a gift for a young person. Oh. And Peggy did a fabulous interview with Lachlan. She talks about that at the beginning of the book, and then sections from that interview introduce the various chapters, the sections of letters, so we get his sensibility.
It's kind of wonderful because you're getting James Lachlan. He's about 85 or 86 when he did the interview. And Peggy conducted that about 2 years before he died and gets some fascinating answers out of him. Once I came on board, I was supposed to go interview him again with a whole new set of questions that we had come up with, but I didn't go up to Norfolk, Connecticut because his wife at the time was ill, and then he died.
What a loss.
But I did get to ask him questions over the years and to know, get some sense of who he was as a person. He was the tallest old man I ever met. He was 6'5".
And a great skier.
And a terrific skier, yes. He's such a fascinating character in and of himself. His family was the Laughlin family of Pittsburgh, which was the Laughlin steel fortune. And he didn't want to go into the family business. And so he didn't inherit that money per se. He actually, when he was at Harvard, lived off an allowance given to him by his Aunt Lila. And with that allowance, he founded New Directions as well as the Alta Ski Lodge.
Two great achievements.
The summer before he started New Directions, he did an internship in Paris with Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. He typed up their press releases and drove them in the countryside and walked their dog. He did an internship with Ezra Pound in Rapallo, Italy at Pound's Esuversity. And the story, which nobody knows exactly how much is apocryphal, is that Pound essentially said, "You're never going to make it as a poet. Do something useful and go into publishing."
Which he did.
Which he did. And then he continued to write his poetry with Pound, William Carlos Williams, and Rex Roth, and E. Cummings as his mentors, and became a celebrated poet in his own right.
That's the rich reward of a good life, you know? So what did you learn about these two men that you didn't know before? This is a real first look at their lives. You know a lot about Tennessee Williams. So what was new to you? What was the discovery?
What was the discovery? That's such a great question. And to answer it, I feel that I have to think back 20 years because I've read them through back then, and that's when the discovery would have been made.
Mm-hmm.
I guess about how much they had in common. I think that's the greatest discovery. They seem on the surface so different in terms of their social life, income, interests, sexual orientation, education, all that. And yet they were both essentially very shy and both reached out in this sort of elegant and gentle way to one another in the correspondence.
And kept it up. Kept it up.
And continued it for four decades, which is, I haven't looked to see, but I don't think you find that quite that often.
I feel I should go home and write you a letter, Thomas. I mean, just...
Shouldn't we?
I know. It does make you think that.
I love writing letters. I could type at the same speed at which I thought, which I can't really do on the computer. I need an IBM Selectric, which is a little slower.
Oh, I love those. Well, I'm glad you've risen from the ranks of typist at New Directions.
Thank you. And up until very recently, everybody who worked there began typing or filing or at the front desk answering the phone. And that includes the current president and publisher.
Wow. Wow. That's a way to begin, I think. Oh, we've been talking with Thomas Keith, who is the editor with Peggy Fox, of The Luck of Friendship, The Letters of Tennessee Williams and James Laughlin. You can meet him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, where he and Peggy Fox will both be appearing. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for schedule times. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Minrose Gwynn has written four scholarly books, including Remembering Medgar Evers, Writing the Long History of the Civil Rights Movement, a memoir, Wishing for Snow, as well as a first novel, The Queen of Palmyra. Now she's back with a blockbuster second novel, one of those big Southern books we all love to sink into. It's called, simply, Promise. I love this book, and you will too. Minrose Gwynn, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
Now, this book is historical fiction of a very high order. Tell us about the event that inspired it.
I'm from Tupelo, Mississippi, and I grew up in my grandparents' house hearing stories about this terribly devastating and historic tornado that hit our town in 1936. So Promise is really a book that found me. It was just at the height of the Great Depression, and Tupelo had just been named the first Tennessee Valley Authority city, the first TVA city. And things were moving along really well. And then this terribly devastating tornado came. The official statistics are that the winds were up to 318 miles an hour. And I know people in New Orleans can appreciate that kind of wind velocity, having experienced hurricanes. And based on these figures, the Tupelo tornado, with its official casualty list of 233 people dead and over 1,000 injured, many of them seriously, is now still the fourth most deadly tornado in the history of the United States. So I grew up with this story, but what I didn't know and what I came to find out a few years ago is that the cold, hard facts of the matter are that the members of the African-American community of Tupelo, which is about a third of the town, were simply not counted in the official casualty figures. And this just gripped me and angered me. I'd heard the white side of the story, but I had never heard the whole story of the Tupelo tornado.
So you set yourself this task to tell the whole story of the tornado. And there are two women at the heart of this book, Debbie, who's one of the town's laundresses, and young Jo McNabb, who's seen her family fall apart around her in the heart of this storm. So tell us about these two and how they come to cross paths.
Debbie is an interesting figure. She's what we in academics call a liminal figure, in that she moves between the white and black population of Tupelo. She is a laundress, and in those days, what a laundress would do is take their little cart and go up to a home, open the front door. They were one of the few African Americans who were allowed to come in the front door, open the front door, gather the laundry that was usually, in my grandmother's case, tied up in a sheet, and take it home and wash it by hand, bleach it heavily, and bring it back the next day or 2 days later. And so she was in and out of white households. Debbie was in and out of white households throughout the town. She is a very strong and wise woman, but she's had a lot of heartbreak. Her granddaughter, Drema, who lives with her, was raped by Joe, the other character's older brother, and the baby, Promise, is the result of that sexual assault. And so she has a lot of anger against Joe's family. Joe, on the other hand, is a very naive 16-year-old white girl who has grown up in a very sheltered way. She has recently acquired a new baby brother, and her interest and her passion after the storm is to find and take care of her baby brother, who's been lost in the storm. Both of these baby boys, Dovey's great-grandson, Promise, and Joe's brother, little brother, Tommy, have been lost in the storm. And as these two women go through this devastated landscape, trying to find these lost children, their paths cross over and over and over again, and they come to have this very vexed but very close relationship because of the tornado and its aftermath.
Now, one of the great freedoms of writing a book like this, I imagine, is that anything can happen during a tornado. It gives you this incredible freedom to create unbelievably compelling visual images. And you really went to town with that.
Yes. When I was growing up, I just heard the wildest stories about this tornado, that the dead and the dying were strewn around town, dangling from tree limbs, buried under debris, buried under chimneys. The stories were very strange. There were, at least in my research, and I did a lot of research for this book, even though I had heard these stories all my life, because I wasn't convinced that all of them were true. And as I found out, they were, at least according to newspaper accounts and oral histories by survivors. There were at least five accounts of flying children who were lost or misplaced. One little boy was very badly wounded and taken to the Memphis hospital on the Frisco Railroad train, which was used to transport the very seriously ill. and no one knew who he was because his whole family had been killed except for his grandfather. And his grandfather saw a picture of him in the Memphis Commercial Appeal several days later and recognized him and was able to claim him. But the stories just went on and on and on. The Lyric Theater downtown was used as a central hospital because the hospital had been too badly damaged for patients to be there. And they were operating on people up on the stage of the Lyric Theater and sterilizing the instruments in the popcorn machine. I recently had my hometown launch at the Lyric Theater in Tupelo. And so it was very compelling to be up there on that very stage where this had occurred so many years ago. So when you read the book, you think, at least I would assume that people might think, that the book contains these elements of magical realism, that things happen that are just so outrageous and so strange that you can hardly believe that they happened. But with the exception of one incident, which I won't say what it is right now, but with the exception of that one incident, I had newspaper accounts that verified a similar kinds of events to everything that's described in the book. And so it did give me a lot of leverage in terms of the kinds of things that I wanted to do. One of the things about a tornado, it just turns everything upside down. And in this case, what I wanted to show was that the tornado, while physically turning everything upside down, it also excavates and uncovers this racial injustice that was so prevalent back in the 1930s. I think that's what I was trying to do.
You think these great weather events would be great levelers, that they would reveal that we are all the same, that we all have the same basic needs and wants. And instead, over and over again, they reveal the cracks and the fissures in civil society even.
Yeah. And in a sense, a tornado or a hurricane or whatever is a great leveler. But what happened in the case of the Tupelo tornado is while the event itself was a great leveler, and the lore around that is that everybody pulled together and there was no race line anymore because everyone was pulling together. But when I went back and questioned that premise against the research, what I found in my research is that the mores, the structures of segregation, immediately after the tornado imposed themselves again, there were listings in the newspapers of that time for the hotels that would house white people and black people, where African Americans could go to get clothing, where whites could go to get clothing, and so forth and so on. Even the what they were called boxcar cities, that the Frisco Railroad had donated a bunch of boxcars for people, for temporary housing for people. They even located the African-American boxcar city about a half a mile from the white boxcar city, just to make sure that line of segregation remained firmly in place.
Well, it's stunning to read, Minrose. I don't think people will ever forget it if they read it, you know? We've been speaking with Minrose Gwynn, whose new novel is Promise. You can see her at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival this weekend. Check TennesseeWilliams.net for times. And you can meet her Wednesday, March 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Minrose, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Make your plans now to attend the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 21st through 25th, headquartered at the Hotel Monteleon and taking place at various locations throughout the French Quarter. Headliners this year include Jamie Attenberg, Brian Batt, Rick Bragg, Donna Brazile, Beth Ann Fennelly, Allison Galen, Richard Ford, Laura Lippman, Amy Ryan, Martin Sherman, Calvin Trillin, and many, many others. The schedule is now available at TennesseeWilliams.net. And don't miss the Women of Williams opening night fundraiser, craft sessions at the Historic New Orleans Collection, and the Stella and Stanley Shouting Contest in Jackson Square Sunday afternoon. Also, over the same weekend, Saints and Sinners, the LGBTQ Literary Festival, will celebrate its 15th anniversary at the Hotel Monteleon. Check out sasfest.org for that schedule. C.W. Cannon reads from his new novel, Sleepy Time Down South, and sings jazz standards with The Racket, Sunday, March 18th at 6 at the Dance Quarter, 1719 Toledano. Room 220 and Antenna present Antonia Crane, Stephen Elliott, and Zachary Lazar, reading their work at the Saturn Bar, 3067 St. Claude Avenue. That's Sunday, March 18th at 7 p.m. Rebecca Solnit, co-editor with Rebecca Snedeker of Unfathomable City and author of many other books, is the Zale Kimmerling Writer-in-Residence at Tulane University this year. Join her for an evening with Rebecca Solnit, Monday, March 19th at 7, and the Lavin Burnick Center at Tulane University. Novelist Minrose Gwynn discusses In Signs Promise, Wednesday, March 21st at 6 at Octavia Books, 513 Octavia Street in New Orleans. Novelist Zachary Lazar, author of Vengeance, and poet Peter Cooley, author of World Without Finishing, discuss and sign their books Thursday, March 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. A Scribe Called Quest reads Thursday, March 22nd at 6:30 at Flores Cafe, 2600 Royal Street in New Orleans. Editor Kathy Chipetta Spies discusses Beautiful Crescent, A History of New Orleans. It's in its 9th edition. That's Thursday, March 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Robert Gordon appears in conversation with Michael Tisserand and then signs his book, Memphis Rent Party, The Blues, Rock, and Soul in Music's Hometown, Friday, March 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Drag queens Asymmetric and Didi Onassis, partnering with Southern Rep Theater, present a drag queen story hour and then guide participants in making their very own Wander Crown. The hour ends with a kid-friendly dance party for ages 3 to 8. This takes place Saturday, March 24th from 2 to 3 at the Children's Resource Center Library. Hilary Shute discusses In Signs Why Comics from Underground to Everywhere, Saturday, March 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society presents its first Meet the Authors event of the spring season, Sunday, March 25th from 2:30 to 4:30 at the Presbyter off Jackson Square. Featured authors are Mayor Mitch Landrieu, whose new book is In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History, Dr. Martha Boone, author of The Big Free, Jeffrey Round, author of Bon Temps Roulé, and Tom Sankton, author of The Betancourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris. Free, but reserve a seat at falkhouse@aol.com, and your pass will be emailed to you in advance. Chandler O'Leary and Jessica Spring discuss and sign their book, Dead Feminist, Historic Heroines in Living Color, Monday, March 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. And start planning now to attend the Delta Mouth Literary Festival in Baton Rouge, April 6th through 8th, which features Anne Gislason, Dylan Krieger, Kiese Lehman, and many others. Check out the Facebook page or deltamouth.com for a complete schedule. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating New Orleans Tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send us your favorites to labooks@wwno.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.